appreciate your invitation to be out as the most dangerous man in America to speak to this morning. I hope that your time will be well spent. I would really like to take 3 or 4 days to talk about the subject that's been given to me, but you probably have to get to work, and so I won't do that. I'll try to summarize somewhat. I'd like to talk to you today about the standard for civil law that we as Christians support and why we support it. I should say, probably before I get underway, however, a word or two about Southern California Center for Christian Studies. This is your commercial interruption, where I'm the resident scholar at present. We're doing work in Christian apologetics and the application of Christianity to life, Christian ethics, and work in Christian theology by way of publication and public speaking and debate. Yesterday, I might mention, on the Jon Stewart Show, I was debating the atheist George Smith. We have a tape of that available if anyone's interested. But on the table, you should find a brochure for the Study Center if you'd like to know more about that organization and the educational services that we offer. In light of the history of Western morals, and specifically in light of the legal history of the United States of America, I think it would appear shameful and perhaps silly to ask whether religious conviction ought to bear upon the practice of politics, whether it ought to bear upon the practice of the law. And yet we have come to just such a point of crisis and confusion in our social outlook today that that's exactly the question that I have to pose for you and attempt to answer this morning. And it turns out that the media has offered an excellent illustration to get us started. I'm thinking here of the present, what I think is politically motivated and certainly media-fueled controversy over Los Angeles Assistant Police Chief Robert Vernon. You've probably seen in the newspapers, you've seen on the television, the kind of thing that's going on here. I'm quoting from the Los Angeles Daily News that Robert Vernon is being investigated, he says, because of my beliefs, and he says he thinks that's against the law. It's against his rights as an individual. And I continue to quote him. He says, "It seems to be frankly outrageous that because a person believes this, we ought to go on a witch hunt to see if it affects his work," Vernon said. Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley added his voice Monday to calls for the police commission to look into whether Vernon's views have affected LAPD policies. Neither the mayor nor other critics have questioned Vernon's beliefs themselves. And now I quote Bradley. "The police commission and the city council, I understand, are taking a look at that, and it's quite appropriate to do so." And Bradley would not elaborate on that. In the interview, Vernon acknowledged that he sought counsel with elders at Grace Community Church in Sun Valley before deciding to arrest protesters opposing abortion in 1989. If the elders had advised him to take no action against the Operation Rescue members, Vernon said he would have stepped aside from the LAPD operation. So what you have here is a public official, in fact, an assistant chief in the Los Angeles Police Department, who openly espouses Christian beliefs and tries to practice them so that when he perceives a possible conflict between his duty as a policeman and his moral obligation as a Christian, when he thinks there might be a conflict, he has the wisdom and the humility to ask for his elders to advise him, and a number of others as well, I've found out, but he asked for these elders at his church to advise him. And this becomes the focus of controversy in our society, becomes the basis for calls for an investigation of this man's beliefs and whether they might possibly have affected his work as an officer of the law. I mean, someone asked that question, you think, now, if you knew the history of this country, if you knew the history of Western morals, if someone were to say, well, what do you think? Do you think that being a Christian might affect your work as a as an officer of the law? The answer, well, I would certainly hope so. I mean, of course it affects his work as an officer of the law. One would think that's one of the reasons why you can count on him. That's one of the reasons why there's integrity and reliability and loyalty, any number of other moral qualities that we would want in officers of the law. But now we're asking the question like, uh-oh, what if the answer should be Yes. What if he should be, in fact, a Christian as a policeman, and not just neutral when it comes to morality and other such things? I think this kind of incident should provoke us to ask some very necessary questions. And those are the ones we're going to be looking at briefly this morning. Let's ask ourselves, should religion be separated from politics? Should it be separated from the law? Is it even possible to separate religion from politics and the law? And what about that highly revered slogan of the separation of church and state? What should we say about that in light of our answers to the previous questions? The first thing we're looking at then this morning is whether the law can be neutral toward morality and religion. Is it even possible for civil law to take a completely neutral stance when it comes to moral principles and religion? Now, I think you can probably tell where I'm going, my answer. I'm going to argue it's not even possible to be neutral. But now, think about this for a moment. If it's not possible to be neutral, then the whole scare tactic of asking the question, do you think his religion affects his work as an officer of the law, becomes almost asinine, doesn't it? Well, of course it does. And if he were a Muslim or if he was an atheist, his religious views would affect his lifestyle and the way he operates as an officer of the law. There's no question about that. I mean, what universe are we living in, for crying out loud, to think that the answer could be anything but yes? So, in a sense, what I'm doing here is trying to take the sting out of the rhetorical nature of that question by suggesting, well, you know, anybody should understand that the question is going to be answered in the affirmative. It has to be. Notice the hypocrisy of suggesting that a person who is a legislator or a policeman or a magistrate of some sort could be neutral with respect to religious principle and morality. The hypocrisy of suggesting that that is the case. The very same people who today tell us that we cannot apply Christian morality to the state, as that would be imposing our views on other people, have absolutely no qualms in imposing their views on me. And you say, well, how do they do that? They're not forcing you to believe anything in particular. Well, today, money that is taken from me, not by a voluntary offering as I give at my church, but at ultimately the end of a gun, I mean the threat of going to prison because I don't pay my taxes, money is being taken from me upon threat of coercion, compulsion, whatever you want to call it, and is being used to fund alleged works of art which I consider obscene and frankly an outright degradation of the Christian religion. And so I am being forced to subsidize my opponents when it comes to religious values and morality. Money is being taken from me, or at least it's going to be resolved one way or another. There's quite a controversy over this. Many people think money should be taken from me to fund state health clinics that not only counsel in abortion services, but provide abortion services. So that my money ends up being used to kill children that I want to defend as innocent and not to be treated in that way, to be defended. And so when people stand up who have done that sort of thing, who are glad to use the strong arm of the state to subsidize their lifestyle and their point of view, even to the point of their antagonism to my Christian values, and then tell me, oh, we don't want Christians, you know, to affect law, I'm saying that's just downright hypocritical. It's a double standard that needs to be exposed over and over and over again until people finally stop acting so foolish and so arrogantly as to suggest, oh, we don't want a moral point of view brought to bear here. Obviously, in the case of homosexual rights, and I would recommend another commercial interruption, recommend my book on homosexuality, where I talk about the principle of civil right and try to point out that homosexuality cannot qualify as one. But those who believe that it is have no difficulty in applying their moral standard to me and to the law when they argue that homosexuals have these rights. You'll see the hypocrisy of those who claim a neutral point of view when it comes to politics and law. If you just go to any of the divorce courts here in Orange County or Los Angeles, actually anywhere in the state of California, and ask yourself whether the way in which divorces are procured and the way in which child custody suits are settled in any way reflects Christian morality, a biblically guided morality. And, of course, you'd be sadly disappointed if you had any high hopes in that regard. The hypocrisy of neutrality. There are those who say that even as Christians, we have to support the idea of a religiously neutral state. They often call themselves pluralist, or recently it's become the fad to call yourself a principled pluralist. If you, as a Christian, think that it is the Christian thing to do to argue that the state ought not to favor one particular point of view religiously or morally, and we need to support only those values which are common to all mankind. A few years ago, I was at a conference where four different views of Christianity and politics were being discussed, position papers presented, and then interaction between the various schools of thought was taking place. And the speaker for principled pluralism was asked whether he would consistently apply this idea that anyone who practices a religion other than Christianity, as long as it's in pursuit of his religious convictions, should be allowed to do that and the state ought not to be prejudiced against it. And he said, well, yes, he would. And then the question came up immediately, what about satanic practices like child sacrifice? Would you then support that? And his response, I mean, talk about who lives in the real world, especially if you're from California, I guess, but his response was, oh, well, there'll always be a lunatic fringe and we don't have to take those kind of questions seriously. In the year following this particular consultation on Christ and civil government, the United States government and agents of the Mexican government uncovered a number of mutilated human bodies that had been the result of satanic sacrifice practiced through this cult called Santeria. The lunatic fringe, you see, the lunatic fringe is in the real world and has to be dealt with and make claims upon the government. Should we be protected in our religious practices? Is this something which in the name of religion can be honored or not? Now, I want you to think about the horns of the dilemma the principled pluralist is now on. He either has to argue, well, I guess when all is said and done, I'm not consistent about being a pluralist. Certain religious practices do have to be suppressed and punished, in which case he's no longer a pluralist. Or he has to argue, no, true pluralism says that you may practice your religious convictions as long as you don't infringe upon the rights and practices of other people. Now, that, of course, is the standard cop-out. And I'm calling it a cop-out because from a debate standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint, you need to notice that when a person says you can do anything you want in the name of religion, except the following things cannot be done, then the question is going to be, well, what if those things that you want to accept, those things which you want to preclude, are being done in the name of that person's religion? What you're really saying is you may practice your religion provided your religion agrees at least this far with my religion that you can't do that, which is not pluralism at all. What it's saying is, and this is where principled pluralists, I think, still get a Christian audience and people without thinking very critically or analytically nod their heads and say, oh, yeah, well, that's a good answer. What they usually say is, you know, people must practice their religious convictions without hindrance unless they conflict with other people's lives or property or their religious convictions. But you see, there are many religions in this world. In fact, the vast majority of pagan religions through the history of mankind have not honored that exception. They have said that they had the right from their gods or whatever god it may be to impose their views and their practices on others. If some virgin does not wish to give up her life in some kind of sacrificial service to Satan, that has not stopped satanic cults through history from claiming their sacrifices their own. Now, that's part of their religious conviction. And when a Christian says, no, you must honor the rights and freedoms of others, what he's really saying is you can be a Satanist modified by Christian values here, the Christian value of respecting other people's freedom or life or what have you. I have a number of newspaper articles that I brought with me today to share with you, just to give you some idea that this is not the lunatic fringe The idea of making religious choices when it comes to civil law comes up all the time. Since we're here in Orange County, the Register is a good source for illustrations. Back in 1981, the Register published an interesting story about tales of voodoo surfacing on a ship that was coming to this country. The Immigration Service was having to look into this, where it turned out that those who were practicing voodoo on the ship had decided that the trouble they were having in their travels had to do with not giving enough human sacrifice to their voodoo gods. And they had killed two people and thrown them overboard, and they had their executioners out for others until some of the people on the ship rose up against this and apparently didn't honor their religious freedom and told them they couldn't do this anymore, and this was being looked into. People practice voodoo today. One that has always been something of a joke to me as a Christian, but if you were a pluralist, I want to know how you could handle this. Back in 1990, you may remember the case of this woman who claimed to be the high priestess of the Church of the Most High Goddess. A contribution had to be given to the goddess, and then the sacrament of the church was to have sex with this woman. And we might ordinarily have called that prostitution, money for sex. But what she did is she tried to get off of the rap of prostitution by claiming that it was really her religious freedom that was being violated in this particular case. Well, if that is your religion, the Egyptian religion of the Most High Goddess, she called it, obviously a farce, but nevertheless, if that's what she claims is her religious conviction, what are we going to say about that if we don't have any objective moral law that is applied to the state? In November of this last year, 1990, I noticed as well in the Register that the Los Angeles City Council was about ready to, passed a law that forbade animal sacrifice, because a number of animals were turning up sacrificed in the Los Angeles area. It was really spooking people, and they didn't think it was right. And so what happened is a lawsuit was filed by the Orisha Temple of the Yoruba religion, saying that their religious freedom was being violated by this prohibition on animal sacrifice. Again, does the state have the right to intervene here, or are we going to be neutral with respect to that? You know that Jehovah's Witnesses are constantly coming up against problems with the law because their understanding of the practice of medicine, which they say is religiously motivated, is violated by hospitals or doctors and so forth. But the same thing happens with respect to the practitioners of Christian Science, and I've brought examples of that with me as well. But I think by now you've gotten the point. Should religious freedom be allowed in any and every case? And I think any right-thinking individual is going to say absolutely not. Even those who call themselves principled pluralists don't believe that religious freedom should be allowed when it comes to the lunatic fringe of Satanism and voodoo and so forth. The fact of the matter is that neutrality is impossible in the practice of law. All law is enacted morality. When someone passes a law that says this should be done or that should not be done, the should and the should not, you see, carry moral force. The reason they should be done or these things should not be done is because the legislature believes that it's wrong that this should take place, that someone's rights are being violated, someone's freedom is being infringed upon, someone's life or liberty or property is being violated when this isn't done or that is done. And that's why we pass laws. You cannot get away from the application of morality to civil law, because civil law simply is enacted morality. However, that's not to say that all morality should be enacted into law. Please notice there's a difference there. All law is enacted morality, but not all morality should become civil law. Okay? We all know, though probably sadly have to confess to the Lord we don't practice self-control, we know that overeating is a sin. But we don't believe that the state should have, you know, restaurant patrols where, you know, policemen are looking into the question of whether you're overeating or not. That is a matter of morality, but it's not a matter of civil law. I trust at this point, we've all learned enough about human hygiene. We believe in brushing our teeth every day, too. And we believe that we're not taking care of our bodies if we don't do that. And yet we don't ask for laws calling for the toothbrush brigade to be called out to make sure in every home in America, children are being taught to brush their teeth and floss and do everything else that's, you know, hygienically correct. Not all morality should be enacted into law. However, everything that is enacted into law has behind it implicitly a moral point of view, and behind that moral point of view, some religious conception of man, the dignity of man's life, his place in the universe, and the existence of God. You cannot escape that. And I'm not going to argue that with you this morning. I trust you understand that, but I'd happy to debate that with anybody that you'd like to bring forward. It's simply impossible to argue ethics apart from a religious conception of man and his place in the universe. And it's impossible to have civil law without moral constructs behind what you're doing. And so can the law be neutral toward morality and religion? The answer is no, it's not even possible to be neutral. I would argue, secondly this morning, for the necessity of a transcendent standard for civil law. If it is the case that civil law needs to have a moral backing, my next point would be the civil law needs to be backed by the transcendent standard of God's own word and revelation, his law. Those of us who work in the area of civil law and ethics will be familiar with a point of view that's called legal positivism. Many of you may be familiar with it as well. Legal positivism is sometimes called the imperatival theory of law, that laws are simply the commands of a sovereign. The point of legal positivism was set out by Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian, and more recently by John Rustin as well. According to legal positivists, there isn't a necessary conceptual connection between law and morals. Law is simply the exercise of power and authority, and whether something is law, whether it is just or not, has nothing to do with its lawfulness. There is an absolute moral obligation, according to positivism, to obey the civil law, no matter how morally iniquitous it may seem to you. That is to say, the injustice of a law does not invalidate the law. Because law is law simply because it's promulgated by someone who's in authority, and it has no reference point conceptually with considerations of justice or morality. And so since there's no reference to justice entering into the definition of law, there is no necessary connection between law and morality, what is the next step going to be? Well, it was taken very clearly by a fellow named Bergbaum, a German legal theorist in this century, in the 19th century, who argued that a legal system that is in operation confers an unconditional obligation upon those under the system to obey the law, even if the law is unjust. Even if there is an oppressive government in power, the legal system provides for peace and order and security, and therefore even oppression must be accepted. The individual must give up his rights for the sake of the many and their security and their order in the society by not resisting a law in the name of some higher law or principle. This finally comes to expression then in the maxim of Lenin at the time of the Russian Revolution, who once said, "We have no mere private law, for with us all has become public law." No one has the right to appeal to a private standard of law or morality or justice to judge then the public law. Everything now with us is public law. Consequently, all legal values will prove to be relative to the society or the system of law in which they are functioning. That's why Hitler's Germany had, from the legal positivist point of view, the right to do whatever it wanted to do with its own citizens. Legal positivism utterly abhors what in history we come to know as the Nuremberg Trials, because in the Nuremberg Trials, those who participated in Hitler's genocide and other inhumane practices were brought to a standard of justice that was not operative in Hitler's Germany. And so what happened is those who were defending the people accused of practicing war crimes said that this was the application of an ex post facto standard of law, because people were being condemned for a law that they didn't live under, and now that they are living under it, it's being applied to their past activities, which would seem to be a very clever legal maneuver, a good debate ploy. The only way in which you could get around that, and is what was used by the prosecutors at Nuremberg, was to argue there is a law higher than human law that is the basis of human civilization. And it's that law that has been violated, and it's for that law that all men live under. Now, I want you to stop and think about that. Nuremberg trials back in the late 40s, right? It's not that long ago. We're talking about merely 50 years ago. People still had this conception of a higher law above the civil law. But now in our day, we have to ask the question, should there be any connection between a man's religious convictions and moral point of view and the practice of law? That's how easily and how soon we can lose our heritage and also our common sense when it comes to this question. A higher law is crucial to any legal system that calls upon people to submit to it, because what it decrees is just and right. Not just the practice of power, but the practice of justice. We try to teach our young people, when I teach ethics classes, one of the major points we begin with, that there's a difference between might and right. Being able to get your way doesn't mean that what you've done is morally correct. And yet, if you don't have the conception of a higher law above the civil law, then of course you have given up that distinction altogether. All law is a matter of might now, and really has no conceptual connection with considerations of right or justice or morality. Many, many years ago, in the early days of the Christian Church, St. Augustine wrote, "Without justice, what are states but great bands of robbers?" Without justice, without a consideration of what is morally right and wrong, if the state is nothing more but the application of power politics, the application of might rather than right, then aren't they nothing more than great bands of robbers? It's just a matter of who has the power to take from others whatever he wants or they want. Think about it. In our state today, we punish people by imprisoning them. We punish people by fining them. And we ought to more often, I believe, although I don't think I'm callous in saying this, we ought to more often punish people by executing them. But now, if there is no consideration of right or justice or morality to the work of the state, whenever a person is fined, how is that conceptually different from stealing from that person? Just that you had the power to do it. When a person is imprisoned, how is that any different conceptually from kidnapping him? It's just that you have enough people and enough firepower to get that done. Or if you execute somebody, how is that any different from murdering them? Unless there is a higher law by which the laws of the state are regulated and evaluated. William Penn said, "Men must choose to be governed by God, or they condemn themselves to be ruled by tyrants." If men will not look for their civil law beyond considerations of might and party and power politics to a higher law, particularly the law of God, then they have actually condemned themselves out of their own mouths. They are logically committed to be ruled by tyrants, by people who will simply apply their own whim and their own power rather than considerations of right and wrong. And so this morning, I trust that you can see the impossibility of neutrality, moral and religious neutrality, when it comes to civil law and the practice of law. And I hope that you understand the menace of pluralism, the idea that in the name of religion, people should be allowed to practice whatever they want to. Neutrality is impossible because all law is enacted morality, even though not all morality ought to be enacted into law. And we see as well the necessity of a transcendent standard for civil law, unless we would degenerate into cultural relativism and lose any concept of a restraint on the state, a consideration of what is right and wrong and what it does and how it punishes people. Well, what should that standard be? Well, I've suggested, you know, my answer is going to be, and I'll come back to that, I believe that the standard should be God's revealed law. I think God tells us what is right and wrong, and where we have the right to infringe on the freedom and the property and the person, the life of another individual. But that's not the only candidate out there today, and I'd like to take a look at a few of these competing ideas for the standard of civil morality and then very quickly summarize where I'm coming from. There are those throughout history, although it's not popular in this country at this time to advocate this, there are those throughout history who have said the despot's desires ought to be the standard of civil law. And by this time, if you don't know how to refute that, then we really need to have an extended session in private to explain to you that arbitrariness is nothing more than what we call tyranny. When a person gets up and says, I don't like people wearing blue shirts, and so execute everybody wearing blue today, we are not talking about a just civil order. We are talking about the application of some madman's desires to people, and has nothing to do with the idea of a transcendent moral standard of law. So the simple desires or whims of the politicians is not going to be the standard of civil law. What should it be? A popular option in this country, and one that is practiced repeatedly, is what we call political paternalism. The idea that the state acts as our father, our pater. And the paternalistic state then does its research and has its commissions and its investigating teams and comes back and tells the legislators what would be best for us. And then the legislature applies that. That is to say, the legislature is always looking out for our best interest. You see arguments over this approach to civil law when the legislature tries to do things like prohibit riding a motorcycle without a helmet. Now, for my money, if you want to ride a motorcycle without a helmet, and that's the kind of insanity that you buy into, well then, you know, you can go for that. If you wish to hurt yourself or to put yourself at risk in that way, you know, that's something that you have the right to do, it seems to me. But the paternalistic idea is, no, the state needs to step in and to watch out for our better interest, even against our own choices. So you have to ask yourself, do we have the right? Do we have the right to do what is not considered by others to be in our own best interest? And it's a popular idea to say, well, no, the state's got to look out for us. But then, you know, you start thinking about certain examples. People will put up with the notion of seat belts, you know, a paternalistic law that requires the wearing of a seat belt. But then you push further and you say, well, now you see, many more people die because of heart conditions and overweight in this country than people die behind the wheel of a car without a seat belt. And so perhaps the state ought also then, in our own best interest, to start regulating salt and sugar consumption. Maybe there ought to be some kind of regulation so that you can only have so much salt every week, so much sugar every week. Now, in principle, I realize everyone will scoff at that and say, well, of course we don't want to do it. That's why this is called a reductio ad absurdum. Because what I'm saying is, you notice the absurd limits to which this political theory would take you. Do people have a right to own a gun? The state says, oh, there will be accidents. You know, children will get hold of guns. And, of course, it's tragic. I don't wish to minimize that. But you need to realize that statistically, there's 1,000 times more chance that your home will be burglarized than that a child will have an accident with a handgun. And yet the state, for the sake, many people will argue anyway, that the state, for the sake of protecting the innocent, these children and others, because of accidents with handguns, will intervene paternalistically and take away our right to bear arms, which may have, it seems to me, far more important purposes, even given the accidents that take place, such as the defense of a housewife against an intruder, and so forth and so on. Perhaps the state should forbid our driving cars. You want to start looking at the automobile statistics and so forth. The paternalistic notion, you see, really fails to distinguish between the state, the family, and God when all is said and done. The state tries to take the place of my father and my family and tries to take the place ultimately of my God by deciding what is right and wrong and best for me. There are those who say that the political standard of the state should be natural law. We should go out and see, you know, how things work in this world and see the regularities in the natural order and then have the state pass laws that would call for us to live in terms of that natural progression and regularity that we see all about us. I've always been confused by how Christians, especially evangelical Bible-believing Christians, would try to use nature as the standard for civil law, for morality at all. I had thought it was one of the basic perspectives of God's Word that we live in a fallen world, and that therefore what the natural man does and what nature itself is doing does not reflect God's ideal and does not reflect necessarily what is right. And in fact, in many ways, we are working against the natural order by bringing in the supernatural grace of God. So just in general terms seems rather strange, but philosophically it seems more than strange. It's downright absurd to say that natural law, natural regularity, should be the basis for our laws. Now, if you look about you, you understand that nature involves such things as weeds and cancer. Those are natural events and things in this world. And yet we don't have any problem thinking it's all right to try to cure cancer, to cut it out of bodies, and to pull up the weeds in our yards. And yet on the natural law theory, one would think that's fighting the natural order. That's got to be wrong. We also see that in the natural order, all of the animals in the natural order are either eaten by other animals or eat other animals. I mean, nature is red in tooth and claw, as we have often been told. That's the natural way. Why shouldn't human beings act like animals, therefore? You will notice in the natural order that dogs in particular, but all kinds of animals, don't always respect sexual boundaries. They don't have concepts of monogamy and fidelity and so forth. We're supposed to believe that we're supposed to act natural like the animals do when it comes to sex. I mean, stop and think about it. Natural law is not the basis much for even a moral standard, much less a moral standard for the state. Then there are those who say, well, the standard ought to be utilitarianism. What makes most people happy? What's in the best interest of the most people? If you stop and reflect on that for just a few moments, you'll see that ultimately utilitarianism degenerates into socialism and finally into tyranny. Because what we're saying is the individual's freedom is not what's important. What's really important is that a larger number of people are happy or taken care of, even if it's at the expense of the individual. Right, a few years ago, the city of Tustin and the police in the city of Tustin were having quite a public relations problem because there was apparently a rapist that was not caught, and the citizens were up in an uproar about this. And let's just assume a utilitarian approach to civil law and the practice of law at this point and ask what is going to be for the greatest happiness of the greatest number in a situation like this. It is true that you have a person, I think, who had committed 3 rapes. Let's say it's 4 or 5. But we have hundreds of people who are upset and concerned, and there's a lack of respect for the law and so forth because we're not getting someone put on trial for this. So what if the Tustin police, this is all hypothetical, if you're from Tustin, this is tongue-in-cheek, please. Should the Tustin police perhaps find somebody who has no family, something of a loner, has BO, is not really liked by people, has no friends who are going to come to his defense and say, we've got our ideal candidate. We'll take him and we will try him for these rapes. We'll make him out to be the person. And then what you have is 500-600 citizens that are up in arms are now calmed down and they're happy. And you got one man who suffered a great deal because he really wasn't guilty. But on utilitarian grounds, why shouldn't the innocent suffer for the greater happiness of the many? There is no answer to that, I don't believe, from a philosophical standpoint. Should majority opinion become the basis of civil law? This seems to be the American way, right? So that if the majority of people should be convinced that Jews should be rounded up and put into gas chambers, the majority opinion would make it right? See, only a few counterexamples is all it takes, really, to undermine that idea. It's one thing to say that decisions should be made by the majority because that's a democratic process. It's another thing to say that right and wrong are determined by the majority. And then there are those, of course, who say, well, the ideal for civil law is everyone should have maximum freedom to do whatever they want to do, except harm other people. This is the very opposite of utilitarianism. Utilitarianism would sacrifice the liberty of the individual for the good of the greater number, or the happiness of the greater number, whereas those who follow the libertarian approach would say the freedom of the individual should be respected, even if many people are unhappy about that. And in my book on homosexuality, I have a chapter that deals with the liberty ideal as an inadequate basis for civil law. Let me just say in passing that you can't even define what that harm is without some moral school of thought or some moral outlook in terms of which you apply your liberty ideal. You say, you have freedom to do whatever you want unless you are harming somebody else. Well, if you happen to be the owner of a hardware store and I open up a competing hardware store across the street from you, and I do a better job of marketing and I sell things at a lower price than you do and give greater and better services than you do, then of course I'm going to harm your business, am I not? I mean, the ideal ultimately is that I'm going to run you out of business. I'm going to have all the customers coming over to my hardware store. Now, should that be ruled out on the liberty ideal, however, because I'm doing harm to you? You can do whatever you want unless it harms someone else. Let's say that a young man and a young woman get married. And because of this young man's understanding of God's calling in his life, he feels he needs to go to school or graduate school or seminary or something somewhere else in the country. And the young lady's parents are going to be emotionally depressed over the fact that their daughter's moving out of the state. Should that be prohibited then because you're practicing your freedom but doing harm, in this case emotional harm, to someone else? See, the libertarian ideal sounds good because we think of very commonsensical applications of it. But when you start pressing its limits, you find it really has no meaning apart from a broader principle of morality in terms of which you operate as to what you have the freedom to do, what kind of harm you can or you may or may not inflict on others. We can be protected from ethical relativism and preserve the concept of political justice, I would argue then, only by finding our source for morality and therefore civil law in God's revelation of moral absolutes. Moral absolutes which reflect his own unchanging character. If you look at the desires of the despot or the paternalism of the state or natural law, or utilitarianism, or majority opinion, or even libertarianism, you're going to run into problems, logical, philosophical, and moral problems that are insurmountable. The only rational, and I believe the only biblical, option is to say that the state's moral value should be determined by the one who is higher than the state, whose law is the law above civil law, and to whom everyone who rules in the state, every magistrate, will eventually give an answer on the day of judgment. In Romans, the 13th chapter, the Apostle Paul says, the powers that be have been ordained of God. He goes on to say, in a way which would be abhorrent in our secular environment today, that magistrates are in fact ministers of God. He uses that religious title. Magistrates in the state are just as much ministers of God as those who stand in the pulpit and declare God's saving word and grace every Lord's Day. They are both ministers of God, called to different tasks, to be sure, but answerable to the same higher authority, God himself. And you know, when you look into the Bible, the amazing thing is you don't find a book that has some kind of narrow, privatized idea of religion. When you look into the Bible, you see the Bible dares, of all things, to declare God's will on any number of subjects, including civil law. In fact, in 1 Timothy, the first chapter, when Paul is talking about appropriate uses of God's law, he says, we know that the law of God is good if a man uses it lawfully. That is, if the law is used according to its own purpose and intention, we know that it's very good. And Paul goes on to give us his illustration. This is the Apostle Paul's chosen illustration of a good use of the law of God. He says, we know that the law was given to restrain murderers and homosexuals and perjurers and other things like this. That is the civil application of God's law. It's the sort of thing the Apostle Paul looked at and he said, well, of course, we know that's good. We can take that for granted. Now, using the law to try to find merit before God, trying to save yourself, of course, that's an unlawful use of the law. It wasn't to be used that way even in the Old Testament. As you see from Paul's epistles, he argues against the Judaizers and the Pharisees from the Old Testament that they have not understood the grace of God. To use the law as a foundation for personal salvation is abhorrent, of course. But what has the law been given for? To give us moral guidance. To define the sin from which we need salvation. To define the way in which we should live our lives. How we should relate to our neighbors. What is just and right and loving. Paul says we know that the law is good if a man uses it lawfully. And of course, an example of that is the civil application of the law of God. In Romans the 13th chapter, where Paul tells us that magistrates are ministers of God, he says in verse 4 that they bear not the sword in vain, but rather are avengers of wrath to those who do evil. The magistrate is to bring the sword, symbolic of the penal sanctions of the state, is to bring the sword down upon those who commit evil. And then you have to ask yourself, well, Paul, what is the standard? What is the definition of evil? And if you go down just a few more verses, Paul recites for us. The saying is in Romans 13 at the 10th verse, you see that Paul's definition of right and wrong, what is good and evil, is taken from the law of God itself. He has no hesitation then to bring God's law to bear even upon what we would call secular states, despotic states, the Roman state itself. And so I've argued this morning that we can be protected from ethical relativism and preserve the concept of political justice only by finding the source of civil law in God's revelation of moral absolutes, which reflect his own unchanging character. An old adage says, "Let the politician tend to the nation's earthly existence, and the pastor to its soul." And what I've argued this morning is that that distinction is not only impractical, it's not morally cogent. You cannot let politicians deal with our earthly existence and think that matters of the soul, morality, and religion have to stay within the confines of the church under the pastor's tutelage. We had better get the preaching of God's word not only to the congregation of God's people, but outside the congregation and applied in the corridors of Sacramento and in Washington, D.C., or else what we will find ultimately is not that our religious principles have been respected and our freedom granted, but eventually a secular concept of civil law will finally eat up our Christian protections as well. The only basis for justice in the state, if it's not going to be tyrannical, the only basis must be a higher law which is revealed by God himself, and that's which we believe as Christians is found in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. In conclusion, let me quote from an article once written by Russell Kirk, which had the interesting title, "We Cannot Separate Christian Morals and the Rule of Law." Kind of looked like the subject of my talk this morning, and I thought that this paragraph might be a fitting conclusion to my remarks. He writes, "Recently the Supreme Court of the United States found unconstitutional a Kentucky statute requiring that the Ten Commandments be posted in public schools. The placards in question bore a notice stating that," and we quote, "the secular application of the Ten Commandments is clearly seen in its adoption as the fundamental legal code of Western civilization and the common law of the United States," end of quote. That was right on the placard of the Ten Commandments. The secular application of the Ten Commandments, foundation for Western civilization. But the Supreme Court ruled, 5 justices against 4, that this educational employment of the Decalogue breached the famous wall of separation. "This decision carried to an extreme," Kirk says, "the doctrine of two swords. The concept that although the spiritual authority and the temporal authority exist in symbiosis, still a gulf must be fixed between the two." He says, presumably the majority of the justices who handed down this decision were not expressing hostility toward Judaism or Christianity. Well, I think they probably were, but he says, certainly they did not acknowledge any religious consecration of the American Republic. Beyond this present neutrality in the courts may lurk the prospect of hostility between church and state, even here in America. And so one thinks of the words of T.S. Eliot, if you will not have God, and he is a jealous God, you should pay your respects to Hitler or Stalin. And so T.S. Eliot and theonomist, reconstructionist, those dangerous people, ultimately agree that the greater danger is that we would not have the law of God as a higher law for our civil law and would not have the protections and guidance that it offers to us. If you will not have God, the jealous God of the Old and New Testament, then you'd better be prepared to pay your respects to Stalin and Hitler in history. Thank you.
Excuse me, I don't do this right up, but our founding fathers, at least for the basis for the First Amendment, talked about the inalienable right to free expression of religion. What is that? You kind of addressed that, but do you think they were in error, or do you reinterpret that? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, one of the things that you are taught when you become a student of God's Word and you want to declare it from the pulpit is how to do historical grammatical exegesis. At least you should be taught it. We may not keep our students from abusing God's Word, but we should be able to make them feel guilty when they do it, as they should learn to read the Word of God in terms of its ancient setting, what the words meant at that point, and the historical circumstances. The same thing has to be applied to the Constitution and the documents of our founding fathers. When, in the earlier days of our country, we talked about the free expression of religion, and we talked about there being no establishment of religion, you have to understand that religion was taken there not to be any and all religions, but it meant the Christian religion, and then by a gracious provision, Judaism as the foundation of Christianity was often incorporated. But you go back and you do historical grammatical exegesis of that, you'll find out that the freedom of expression meant the freedom of Congregationalists to speak, even if they disagree with the Presbyterians, who could speak even though they disagree with the Roman Catholics, who disagree with the Lutherans, and that sort of thing. The free expression of religion meant the free practicing and expression of religion within the confines of Christianity. That is, it was a denominational pluralism, not what we would consider a world religion pluralism in that day. And there are things written by John Whitehead and Gary DeMar and others that you can read that will give you historical substantiation for that. And so I'm in favor of the free exercise of religion. Somebody might say, well, but you've got, if you want to freely practice your Christian religion, you have to be willing to let all religions, you know, practice. And I'm saying, well, here we are back to Santeria and Voodoo and the Orisha Temple and others as well. No one, I mean, people say this, and they get a lot of public support, and it's great public relations, and people will say they believe in the free exercise of religion in this broader sense. But I maintain no one really believes that. They say it. No one really believes it. And if they do, I'll be glad to give them a few illustrations and see if they really want to gag on them or if they're going to, you know, say, no, I don't believe that can be practiced. And since everyone draws the line somewhere, for us as Christians, the issue becomes, how do we decide where to draw the line? Do we draw the line on the despot's desires, utilitarianism, natural law, majority opinion? We're right back to the same thing. And my answer is you can only draw the line on the basis of God's own word and revelation.
Another question.
There. Is there any theonomistic foundation for civil laws that are drug laws?
That's a very good question of application. Once we are agreed that we have to go to the Bible for our standard of civil law, then we have to get down to the nitty-gritty of interpreting the Bible and making modern application. That's not always an easy thing. I'm going to give you a thumbnail answer to your question, but I think most important would be in my answer to indicate to you that this is an issue of application rather than a question of what I've been arguing today about the foundation of civil law. I may be wrong, you may not agree with the answer I'm going to give you here, but that calls for all of us to go back and look at the Bible and say, what does it actually teach? Maybe Bonson's mistaken on that. But if I'm mistaken on the application, I trust you will not necessarily think I'm mistaken on the idea that the foundation of civil law ought to be God's own word in Revelation. My own conviction is, I do grant a great deal of leeway to the individual over against the authority of the state, unless the Word of God lays down penal sanctions for certain activities that the magistrate is to carry out. And so, strange as it may seem, this most dangerous man in America image that is sometimes given, it goes hand in hand with a person who believes in that civil authority is very narrow, very closely circumscribed. And I don't believe that the Word of God teaches that the state has the right to punish people for drug abuse. That isn't to say that I believe in drug abuse. I mean, no matter how many times you lay that out there, I realize I'll still hear back from some corner that, you see, I promote drug use now or something. I don't do that at all. And I believe the sanctions of the church and the family and the marketplace ought to be, very rigorously applied to try to stop drug abuse and so forth. But I don't believe God has given the right to the state to do that sort of thing, any more than I think God has given the state the right to regulate what we read. And therefore, as out on a recent speaking trip, and I did something on the question of pornography, and I think anyone will know who's read my materials, heard my lecture, that I'm very much down on pornography, and I write against this pornographic stuff that the state is funding and so forth. On the other hand, I don't believe the state has the right to start telling us what we can and cannot read. And the cost of arguing for that civil liberty is that means I grant my neighbor the right to read Playboy, so that the state doesn't take away my right to read the Bible someday.
Can we broaden this to more, you kept it more national, grade in your views about biblical law in the state. I was wondering more internationally speaking, when in the past, I know enough about you to know that you would biblically oppose, let's say, the involvement in Vietnam. Would you also apply that to involvement in Iraq? And how do you draw that, the sensibility of the Christians to defend the poor and the impoverished and the people who cannot defend themselves with that overall view? And I give another example. If I was to walk down the street and I saw somebody bullying somebody, I try to get involved. However, if I saw 1,000 people bullying that person, I may not want to get involved because I couldn't get away with it. There's that analogy as well. We can get away with it in Iraq, and maybe we thought we could in Iran or in Vietnam, but we probably can't get away with it when the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland.
Right. Yeah. Well, you put your finger on a real problem. When a state, be it the United States or some other, when a state decides it will play policeman of the world, it better stop and ask itself whether it means seriously and consistently to play that role, or whether it's going to do it only when it's in its own selfish interest. And if it's doing it in its own selfish interest, finally, that is what determines intervention or non-intervention, then one has got to ultimately, as a Christian, say that is not a moral application of what you consider God's given, your God-given vocation. Now, on top of that, I don't believe God has given the vocation to the United States government to play policeman of the world, and I don't believe he's given it to France or China or to anybody else. This is an opportunity for another commercial interruption, I guess, but during the time of our involvement in Iraq, I was lecturing around the country on a Christian view of war, specifically to help God's people think through these principles. And you can get that from Covenant Tape Ministry with a study guide that goes with it for, I think, $25. It's three tapes. Now, when I gave this, for instance, in Akron, Ohio, originally, I suggested on the first evening of the conference, I said, I believe that by the time we finish this conference, you will find that both the Dubs and the Hawks in the audience are not going to be happy with what I've had to say. And that turned out to be true, although the vast majority of the audience was convinced by what I had to say. They did have to agree that you cannot, the dovish and the hawkish philosophies of war that are often parlayed in our country today do not reflect the full complexity of God's word on a question like warfare. And I do want you to get the tapes and to listen to the whole thing, but the thumbnail sketch answer, Howard, is that the state has the right to engage in warfare only as an extension of its police powers. That is to say, the state has the right to defend me against, say, you breaking into my home, or 10 of your friends breaking into my home, or 10 people from Mexico coming to break into my home. The state has the right to extend its police powers to defend its citizens against foreign attack and assault. And sometimes that means preventive strike. I realize when there's a clear intention to aggress against you, sometimes our state has to take the first step to stop that from taking place. But all of that comes under the general theory of a defensive theory of war. And so if you take that, which I think is a biblical approach, I would argue that what we did in Iraq was not an extension of the police powers of the state, but even, I mean, the President of the United States admitted it was really the application of what's called a crusade theory of war, to make the world safe for democracy, or to help the oppressed, or to stop the global spread of communism. Throughout the years, we hear different rationales, but all of those have the idea that there's a positive principle that we are trying to protect or promote in the world, and that's why we go to war. And I don't see biblical justification for that. This leaves then finally the question, which tugs at everyone's heart, what about oppressed people? I mean, when you have a big bully state beating up on one of its local neighbors, are we as Christians or as Americans just to stand by and to let that happen? And I'll bite the bullet. Morally, yes, because God has not given us the right to intervene in a situation like that. Remember that when George Bush decides to intervene in a case like that, it's not George Bush who's going over saying, look, I will personally, as an individual, volunteer my money, my life, my time, whatever, to help these poor oppressed people. When George Bush and others make those decisions, what they mean is my son and your neighbors are going to go do their bidding in a case like that. And God hasn't given them the right to make those decisions. We have the right as individuals to do that. But the government doesn't have the right to expend the money and the property and the blood of its citizens for just any good cause in the world. Well, isn't there anything a Christian can say in a case like this? Well, there is, but it calls for a more principled approach to government than what we practice, and therefore it's going to seem a little strange and remote from what we can do. But I argue in these tapes that what we really need to be looking for eventually is a Christian version of the United Nations, or if you will, an internationalized version of what the United States was originally to be, where, for instance, you have a commonwealth like Virginia and one like Pennsylvania, who are all under a federal constitution and yet recognizing individual differences in their state constitutions and practices and so forth. And I believe eventually what we'll have to see happen is oppressed nations will gain the protection of stronger nations by coming under a common constitution, that is, becoming part of this federation of nations where they protect each other because they are committed to each other, they have the same responsibilities, the same taxes, and the same privileges. I think it is morally wrong for even an oppressed nation to expect the privileges of citizenship and not have to pay the price and follow the responsibilities of citizenship. And you see the glaring inequity of not recognizing this principle that privilege and responsibility go hand in hand. When we go over to help ultimately the Saudis protect their oil fields, and the Saudis impose on us their religious conceptions, so there's a restriction on the practice of those, sadly few, but nevertheless, genuine Christians who are there, who want to celebrate Christmas or pray or have their Bibles or have religious literature sent to them. And the Saudis, who are taking our money and using our spilt blood for their protection, imposing then on our religious freedom. And I think that's abhorrent. If you wish to have the protections of citizenship, you must also follow the responsibilities. And so my answer, it's long term, we're going to do a lot of changing and so forth, but ultimately oppressed nations need to join that nation from whom they ask protection and come under its constitution, pay its taxes, and act as responsible citizens of that, and then they get the privileges that go with it. So there is a Christian answer to that, but it calls for obviously, missionary endeavor and the extension of Christian principles around the world.
I wish we had hours. I'm sure there's even the answers raise lots of controversy and lots of questions. And you're going, man, let's ask this guy, oh, what does he believe? What does he believe? But we have to go. So thank you very much. Stay with us. Stay tuned. You know, if you have more questions, stay around and ask Greg some questions. I'm sure he'd be happy to answer some of those.